The headlines: Israeli forces conduct another deadly raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank, shooting a young Palestinian in the head. At least four Syrian soldiers are killed in Israeli missile strikes near the Syrian capital, Damascus. In Russia's tough response to the West's sanctions over the Ukraine war, Gazprom shuts off gas to Bulgaria and to Poland. Our top story for this half hour: the Israeli regime intensifying its crackdown across the occupied West Bank out of the international Quds Day. The latest sign of violence happened at the Jenin refugee camp hours ago, where a young Palestinian was shot in the head and three others sustained injuries. Since March, Israel has escalated its violent raids across the occupied territories, prompting retaliatory Palestinian operations. The Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds has been a flashpoint, with Israeli forces brutally attacking Palestinian worshippers during the holy month of Ramadan. After more than 70 years of its creation, the Israeli regime continues killing and oppressing Palestinians, demolishing their homes and confiscating their lands. In recent weeks, the regime has intensified its violent crackdown on Palestinians, especially worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque ahead of International Quds Day. We've interviewed a number of people in different countries to get their views on the Israeli escalation in the occupied territories. Let's take a listen.
They are the Palestinians. They are being victim from the last 10, 20 years. And it's not the basic the violation of the human rights, but it's the violation of regional rights. It's the violation of the world, all the basic humanitarian policies, rules, regulations, everything. So what I believe that the Palestinian, they are not getting the concentration, they are not getting the facilities, they are not getting the concentration from the all authorities. I think I personally strongly condemn because they attacked on the worshippers, and it's really, you know, they are violating the rules, and not just the rules, they are violating the basic worship's values. So the Israelis, and this attack is not new, because they are used for this. The problem is that the country, the world, the people, they are not focusing on these violations. This is also a major disaster and the problem which we are facing from the last two decades.
I feel great pain for our Palestinian brothers, because they are suffering, from the last many years. They are suffering brutalities, and you know they are victim of aggression from Israel. And this issue must be settled with the dialogue. And you know, in this holy month of Ramadan, they are facing firing and bombing in the holy places. Actually, it is the violation of international peace agreements. And you know, United, it is actually, you know, the question for United Nations that they established a platform, international platform, for dialogue and smooth solution of all, you know, complicated issues. So it is need of the hour that United Nations must intervene in this regard, and they should, create a suitable solution for both parties.
Under the pretext of maintaining security, Israeli occupation forces, they attack Palestinian worshippers in the occupied city of Al-Quds, provoking them while on their way to Al-Aqsa Mosque. It's not something new. This kind of sort of uprising, popular uprising, it's meant to send a signal message that Palestinians are steadfast in the face of oppression. Israeli occupation forces, they will fail to force Palestinians to raise the white flag. Palestinians have been fighting for this self-determination and struggle for the past 75 years. They will continue to do so, they sending a message also that they are fighting the oppression on behalf of the Muslim world. Unfortunately, Palestine is not Ukraine, and we've seen the reaction of Israeli occupation forces attacking not only Muslim Palestinians, also Christian Palestinians, worshippers, whether they are from Palestine or foreigners, also the commander attack. So their action is the norm. Unfortunately, Israel can get away with its justification. Even the Israeli prime minister, he did not admit that it is Israeli illegal settlers who provoke and initiate these violations. We've seen images of Palestinian worshippers being handcuffed inside Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is Islam's third holiest site, the first Qibla for Muslims. We've seen shy and weak reactions from the Middle Eastern governments, from the Muslim world. Palestinians, obviously, they do not pin hope on Arab governments anymore.
It's not really a conflict. Israel took Palestinian lands, so we talk about conflict when it's not. It's just genocide. They are erasing an entire population for decades. So yeah, so it's not comparable. Not just regular people, children, old people, mothers, fathers, everyone, not just worshippers. It goes beyond just a religious conflict. Not conflict, but divergence.
Happening earlier this morning in Syria, four Syrian soldiers have been killed in an Israeli air raid targeting positions in the vicinity of the capital, Damascus. The defense ministry says three more soldiers have been wounded. According to local media, Syrian air defense has intercepted most of the missiles over Damascus. Israel frequently targets areas inside Syria with airstrikes. The attacks mainly target military sites as well as the positions of resistance fighters battling terrorist groups. Palestinian and Syrian artists have participated in an exhibition in Damascus to mark International Quds Day, with the aim of stressing the role of art and culture in promoting the Palestinian cause. Our correspondent Mohammed Ali reports from the Syrian capital.
A fine arts exhibition has been held in Damascus marking International Quds Day in collaboration between the Syrian and Palestinian fine arts unions, as well as the Iranian Cultural Center. Participants showcased many paintings that focused on Palestinians' adherence to their rights despite the brutal acts of Israeli occupation forces.
On Quds Day, our work interpreted the fact that Quds is our cause and that it's become an international cause. We're participating to stress the importance of Palestinian identity and that Quds is the capital of Palestine.
We expressed through our paintings the Palestinian struggle. Uprisings happening now and all forms of our people's resistance, whether in stones, hands, or weapons. The exhibition is a reflection of Palestinians' reality in the eyes of the artists.
Political and cultural figures toured the exhibition, underlining the pivotal role such events play in countering Israeli attempts to erase Palestinian culture.
Resistance can be in armed struggle as well as in culture, media, art, politics, and popular movements. Art has a main role in our battle in unifying the people and embodying the steadfastness of Palestinians.
There is an Israeli attempt to change the shape of Jerusalem al-Quds, not just through Judaizing the population, but by replacing Palestinian culture and giving an impression that the history of Quds is Jewish. This is why it is important to highlight the Palestinian identity, culture, and resistance.
Quds International Day, set by late Imam Khomeini in Ramadan every year, has been a day of unified action by millions of people who wish to express solidarity with Palestine. Artists use their artwork to visualize Palestinians' struggle and resistance against Israel. It's a message they are sending in their own way on Quds Day, hoping they help attract the attention of the international community to Palestinians' decades-long suffering. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
A Chinese top military delegation led by the country's defense minister is in Tehran for meetings with high-ranking Iranian defense authorities. Upon arrival, General Wei Fenghe met with Iran's defense minister, Mohammad Reza Gharoui Ashtiani. The Chinese minister scheduled to hold talks with other top-ranking Iranian military officials to discuss the latest international and regional developments, as well as ways to improve interactions between the two countries' armed forces. Moscow halts gas supplies to Poland and Bulgaria after the two countries refused to pay for Russian energy exports in rubles. The move by the energy giant Gazprom has raised further tensions in Europe, which is heavily reliant on Russian gas. In a statement, the company says supplies will not resume until Sofia and Warsaw abide by the new terms. That refers to President Vladimir Putin's announcement last month that unfriendly countries will have to pay for their gas in rubles or would risk losing gas supplies. Meanwhile, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov has rejected accusations of using natural gas as a tool of blackmail, saying that Russia remains a reliable supplier of gas and oil. The reaction came after Ukraine blamed Moscow for using its energy to, quote, shatter the unity of its Western allies. Paolo Raffone, the Secretary General of the CIPI Foundation, says the halt to Russia's gas deliveries will push up prices and negatively affect the economic situation across Europe.
Well, there is no doubt that the suspension of supplies of gas to European countries, for the time being only Poland and Bulgaria, will increase the price of gas in Europe and therefore the inflationary trend. And this will certainly have an immediate effect on the livelihood and the conditions of the economy in the entire Eurozone. And we already see that the euro is slipping down to the dollar every day. There will be maybe some kind of raise in interest rates by the ECB sometime in June, July, but it will be late and small because they know very well that if they raise it, they will hit the enormous debt that several European nations have. So it is a way to conduct the war through economic means, which is specular to the one that the Europeans have done to Russia through the so-called sanctions.
Russia reports several blasts in the country's south and a fire at an ammunition depot in the city of Belgorod as the war with Ukraine is in its 63rd day. Local Russian officials say the explosion caused no casualties or damage and that the blaze had been extinguished. Ukraine has not directly claimed responsibility but described the incidents as a payback for Russia's war on its neighbor. Belgorod has been targeted several times by Ukrainian forces since the start of the conflict. Meanwhile, Russia says it has hit an arms depot in southeastern Ukraine with missiles. The Russian Defense Ministry says the depot in Zaporizhia was used to store weapons supplied by the United States and European countries to Kiev. The passage of a U.S. warship through the sensitive Taiwan Strait is drawing protests from China, which is calling the move provocative. According to a statement by the Chinese military, the U.S. actions not only deliberately harm peace and stability in the waterway, but they also send wrong signals to Taiwan forces seeking independence. In response, the U.S. Navy has said that the warship only conducted a routine transit that is allowed under international law. China considers the island as its territory and views such U.S. activities as a sign of support for Taiwan. Washington has no diplomatic relations with Taiwan, but is the island's most important international supporter. and arms supplier. Well, the dust has settled after France's election, and many say the nation isn't looking too well. A lackluster election has revealed extreme divisions, which President Emmanuel Macron may only worsen. Romy Mazzarin has more from Paris.
With the re-election of President Emmanuel Macron, France's mainstream media has stopped worrying about fascism and started to honestly discuss the state of the country. A France divided is the most common headline. In 2017, Macron promised to not give France a reason to vote for the extremes of the political spectrum, but the far right and the far left have both grown to new highs.
It's a good thing Macron was re-elected. We need a young, efficient, pro-European president with a long-term vision. I'm surprised at the high score for the National Front, but in their economic program, they forget that it's the bosses who are in charge of salaries and not the president.
Le Pen won just 5% of the vote in the capital, while out of 101 departments, she carried 30 of them, mostly rural. She secured just one department in 2017. 80% of voters described the presidential campaign as being of poor quality, and few desired a rematch of 2017.
I didn't vote in the second round. In the first round, I voted for third place finisher Jean-Luc Mélenchon and decided to abstain. I think it's better that Macron won instead of Le Pen, who is too extreme right for me.
Macron's problem is that, once again, he can't claim his win signifies a broad mandate for his proposals. Subtract 39% of the total electorate due to abstention and purposely spoiled ballots, and Macron's 58% of the vote falls to just 35% of the electorate. If we fairly assume that, like in 2017, 43% of his voters only did so to block Le Pen, then just 20% of the total electorate chose Macron for his policies or personality. That's a drop of 4 points from 2017. If Macron continues to rule as if his policies don't need a broad popular mandate, then France's permanent social unrest seems likely to continue. A Le Pen victory would have set off immediate protests, but for now, a calm resignation is reigning. However, few expect the Paris street or the rural roundabout to remain quiet for very long. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. You and I must feel the presence of God when taking or abandoning an action. If this happens, then divine blessings will come pouring. This is the same thing that was mentioned in Surah Al-Hud. In the chapter, we read that heavenly blessings will be showered on us. Heavenly blessings are not limited to rain. They include everything, including divine mercy. Shower your blessings on us. This attentiveness of us will be beneficial to the people, the Islamic Republic, the country, and to ourselves, because it gets our hearts closer to spirituality and the pure life offered by God. Well, these were the words of advice that I wanted to discuss. Of course, as I said before, I myself need them more than all of you. I hope that God will help us be influenced by these words of advice.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
As for the recommendations, I have a number of recommendations for you, dear brothers and sisters, who have entered the arena of governmental responsibility, including in the Majlis, the Parliament, in the administration, and in various other organizations, as a fresh group of people have entered the field. In particular, I have recommendations for young officials. Fortunately, a large number of youths have found their way in the body of the government. This is very gladdening if they take care of themselves. The recommendation that I wish to offer today is attention to detriments. One is arrogance and another is passivity. These are two detriments that you must meticulously be aware of. Arrogance is Satan's weapon. Arrogance and hubris is Satan's weapon, and it has different sources. It does not matter where it originates from. Sometimes it originates from your position. Imagine that previously you used to work in a remote area. Now you have undertaken a higher managerial position. For example, in the Majlis, in the parliament, in the administration, and in revolutionary organizations or in the armed forces. This might make one arrogant due to the position that one has achieved. This is one origin of arrogance.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
In a recent report by the New York Times, Canada's main city of Toronto was described as the Wild West of marijuana shops. According to the report, Ontario's provincial government permitted the shops by emergency order to keep operating during the COVID-19 pandemic, even during lockdowns. During this period, to the investors' delight, shares in the stocks of licensed medical marijuana growers in Canada have multiplied in price. However, the marijuana business was already expected to flourish, even before the pandemic started in 2019 and right after Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, to fulfill a campaign promise, introduced legislation to legalize the recreational use of marijuana in Canada. The prospects look good. Eventually, the Government of Canada legalized cannabis for recreational use on October 17, 2018. The Cannabis Act creates a legal and regulatory framework for controlling the production, distribution, sale, and possession of cannabis in Canada. Canada is now the second nation after Uruguay to completely legalize marijuana as a consumer product, in an effort to extinguish the criminal trade and keep the substance out of the hands of youth by regulating the market. However, growing, importing, exporting, or selling marijuana, particularly to minors, outside licensed channels, remain a serious crime. Meanwhile, critics of the cannabis law highlight the damaging impact to society of the widespread use of the drugs. When the use of cannabis becomes more widespread, the drug can also have downsides, including acute injuries and illnesses. In some cases, marijuana could lead to cyclical vomiting syndrome, a condition characterized by vomiting and severe abdominal pain. And also, those who use cannabis are more prone to mental illnesses. While many shops remain closed in Toronto, following several rounds of lockdowns and many office towers in the city remain mostly empty, the marijuana shops apparently have a booming business. They were permitted by the provincial government's emergency order to keep operating during the pandemic. In March 2020, during the early months of the pandemic, there were only 12 cannabis shops, but now there are 430 shops with another 88 in the approval process. When Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's government legalized marijuana in 2018, its primary goal was to create a more equitable justice system. By putting an end to heavily racialized arrests, possession, not a major new business sector. According to a recent government-sponsored report, in only 3 years, sales of legal marijuana in Ontario have outpaced estimates of unlicensed sales and boosted the economy by $10.6 billion. Polls indicate that more Canadians consume it than they did before, 25% of people 16 and up. Violence at the Al-Aqsa compound has surged during the fasting month of Ramadan. It all began when dozens of Israeli military forces stormed into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied Old City of Al-Quds and restricted the entry of Palestinian worshippers into the Flashpoint holy site to secure the incursion of hundreds of extremist settlers to mark the Passover holiday. Regime forces assaulted Muslim worshippers inside prayer halls while protecting the Israeli settlers desecrating Islam's third holiest site. So far, at least 19 Palestinians have been killed, while hundreds more have been injured in clashes with Israeli forces. This has raised concerns about a slide back into the wider Israeli-Palestinian conflict, like the one in May last year when frequent acts of violence against Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque led to an 11-day war between Palestinian resistance groups in the besieged Gaza Strip and the Israeli regime. But why is the Al-Aqsa compound a central point of contention in the issue of Palestine? Israel-occupied East Al-Quds, where Al-Aqsa is located, during the 1967 Arab-Israeli War. It annexed the entire city in 1980 in a move never recognized by the international community. The illegal Israeli control of East Al-Quds, including the Old City, violates several principles of international law, which outlines that an occupying power does not have sovereignty in the territory it occupies. Following Israel's occupation of East Al-Quds, a delegated status quo was agreed upon, with Jordan giving Muslims the sole right to pray at Al-Aqsa and Jews at the nearby Western Wall. However, Palestinians accuse Israel of restricting Muslim worship at Al-Aqsa while not doing enough to enforce the ban on Jewish prayer at the compound and even protecting the violators. The ensuing Israeli aggression against Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa compound is a flagrant violation of the status quo. Next, what has the international community done to put an end to Israeli violence against Palestinians? Well, the regime in Tel Aviv continues its crimes with total impunity, and the international community is silent, except for a few words of caution. The United Nations believes it suffices to express deep concern over the worsening security situation in the occupied Palestinian territories, saying it will probe into the use of force at Al-Aqsa. But is that enough? Perhaps the world's largest and most familiar international organization is too busy, preoccupied, or distracted with the Russia-Ukraine war, but the issue of Palestine deserves the same, if not more, attention since it has been ongoing for several decades. Thousands of people across the globe have taken to the streets to deplore Israeli violence against Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and elsewhere in the occupied territories, as the regime in Tel Aviv continues its crimes in Palestine. In Pakistan, thousands of people took part in rallies after Friday prayers in major cities, denouncing the Israeli attacks on Palestinian worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque as naked terrorism and urging Islamic countries to intervene immediately to protect the sacred site and Palestinian lives. Also in Bangladesh, thousands of people demonstrated against the Israeli onslaught. Elsewhere in Jordan, the protesters called for the expulsion of the Israeli ambassador and Amman's withdrawal from the Jordan-Israeli peace treaty signed in 1994. Pro-Palestinian rallies, however, have not been limited to Muslim-majority countries. Rallies were held in the US as well as European capitals such as Amsterdam, London, and Berlin. The protesters called for international action, including sanctions to end the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories and the regime's growing aggression.
And so we're on a continuous upward trend, a continuous upward surge in support for Palestine and support for the boycott and isolation of the Israeli occupation and in standing with the Palestinian resistance.
More protests have been organized in other countries worldwide. One of the many online websites promoting resistance against Israel is Samidun. Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, which has urged all Palestinian, Arab and international supporters of Palestine to organize events and confront Israeli massacres and ethnic cleansing, events which are held by different organizations around the world.
Israeli military forces have raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds as worshippers gathered for dawn prayers, with medics reporting that more than 40 Palestinians were injured as a result of the raid. Local sources said some worshippers were trapped inside the mosque amid clouds of tear gas, with the regime troops throwing stun grenades at them. According to the Palestinian media, at least 43 Palestinians were injured in the raid. The development comes a day after as many as 30 Palestinians were wounded after Israeli forces continued their violent attacks against worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied Al-Quds. The troops used rubber bullets, tear gas canisters, stun grenades, and pepper spray against the worshippers, who have been braving increasing aggression ordered by the Israeli regime since the beginning of the holy fasting month of Ramadan.
Right now, the site of the mosque is sacred to three major religions, but the Israelis have no consideration for anyone but themselves and their own wants and desires. So right now, when they are entering the mosque, the sacred mosque, attacking people while they're praying, worshippers are there for dawn prayers, and the IDF soldiers and the settlers are simply invading the mosque, firing tear gas, rubber bullets, and live rounds of ammunition sometimes, all to terrorize and drive them away because they want the site completely for themselves.
The series of raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, one of the holiest sites in Islam, began last Saturday when the Israeli troops injured more than 150 Palestinians there. Israel's new campaign against the Palestinians doesn't stop at the occupied West Bank. On Thursday, the Israeli army carried out airstrikes across the Gaza Strip, targeting positions belonging to the resistance groups. Similar developments last year led to an 11-day war between Israel and Gaza-based resistance groups. The conflict killed over 260 Palestinians, including scores of women and children. The Arab League broke its silence on the Israeli raids on Al-Aqsa, calling on the regime to prevent Israelis from entering the compound. In an emergency meeting in the Jordanian capital, Amman, the organization warned that Israel's actions threaten to ignite a cycle of violence, and the attacks and violations represent a blatant provocation to the feelings of Muslims. But how will such declarations help defuse the situation when, ironically, countries that have recently normalized their ties with Israel, including the United Arab Emirates and Morocco, were in attendance at the meeting? People took to the streets of the Jordanian capital, Amman, in solidarity with the Palestinians on Friday, calling on the government to expel the Israeli ambassador and scrap a peace treaty signed with the regime. Such protests have been held in several different countries, but without a unified international response to Israel, the protests are unlikely to be enough to put an end to such violations.
The international community, as you mentioned, is not doing anything about this. It's so hypocritical to see the international community condemn the things that the Russians are doing to the Ukrainians when the Israelis are doing the exact same things to the Palestinians, and their crimes are supported by the United States and other nations.
In the absence of any practical measure taken against the regime, resistance seems to be the only option.
Russian President Vladimir Putin announced on Thursday that Russian forces have won the battle for the strategic southern city of Mariupol. Russian forces appear to be in control of the city, including its important but now seriously damaged port. At a joint appearance with his defense minister Sergei Shoigu, Putin declared that, quote, the completion of combat work to liberate Mariupol is a success. The Russian president offered congratulations to Shoigu and Russian forces. But what is the strategic significance of the latest developments of the war? Mariupol is a major port in Ukraine's eastern Donbass region. It is situated between areas held by pro-Russian forces in Ukraine and Crimea, the Black Sea Peninsula that came under Russian control in 2014. Taking the city now will allow Russia to connect the two areas as it steps up its military campaign in Ukraine's east. Moscow can now secure more of the southern coastline, complete a land bridge between Russian soil and the Crimean Peninsula, and free up more troops to join the battle for Donbass, which is Ukraine's eastern industrial heartland. Despite Russia's announcement of victory in Mariupol, hundreds of Ukrainian troops and civilians are still holding out inside a giant steel factory in the city. Russian forces have tried for weeks to dislodge them, but to no avail. The Kremlin says there is no need for Russian troops to enter the complex passageways of the sprawling Azovstal steelworks. The Russian president ordered his forces to block off the industrial area so that, quote, not even a fly can get through. Ukraine and its Western allies have disputed Russia's claim of complete victory in the city. But Moscow seems to be already looking beyond the southern city. Russian officials say the war's main objective is now capturing the mostly Russian-speaking Donbass region. Last month, Russian forces were driven away from the capital Kiev and northern Ukraine. Things will definitely not be smooth in the east either, as Western nations rush to funnel heavy arms into Ukraine to help it counter the offensive.
The Ukrainian armed forces were trained by NATO, equipped by NATO, and trained to the standards of NATO. So that is a major factor as to why the Ukrainian armed forces have put up stiff resistance to the Russian army.
U.S. President Joe Biden has announced another $800 million to help Ukrainian forces fight in the east. He said this week that Washington and its allies are moving as fast as possible to provide Kiev with the weapons that it needs. According to Biden, the U.S. and its allies are facing a critical window of time where they are going to set the stage for the next phase of this war. Much is at stake in Ukraine for major world powers. The war has been widely described as an escalation of the never-ending tug of war between the West and the Russian Federation. The outcome of the conflict could have far-reaching consequences and may shift the balance of power in the region and beyond.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Fasting of the month of Ramadan is an important pillar of
Allah. إِنَّمَا سُمِّيَ رَمَضَانَ لِأَنَّهُ يَرْمَضُ الذُّنُوبِ.
Verily, the month of Ramadan has been thus named because it scorches away sins.
What does Maah Ramadan mean to us?
This is Dialogue, a program on the holy month of Ramadan and the importance of fasting. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to the program. This is Dialogue. We're talking about the blessed and holy month of Ramadan. The holy month of Ramadan, as you all know, is the blessed and honorable month when the doors of the Almighty Allah's mercy are open. It is the blessed month when forgiveness is easy to gain, but only if we take our steps in this direction. The holy month of Ramadan, the great month when the doors of hell are closed, a beautiful, a blessed, an honorable month, a month where we return towards the Almighty Allah. The holy month of Ramadan, a month where we gain our provisions for our journey towards the hereafter. The holy month of Ramadan, where we establish a connection with our loving, nurturing Lord, our Creator and Sustainer, Allah, exalted and glorified is He. The holy month of Ramadan, the greatest of months, the most honorable of months. This month in which we can return towards Allah. This month in which we can reconnect with Allah. This month in which we can gain the provisions for the hereafter. This, the holy month of Ramadan.
قال الإمام الصادق عليه السلام: من لم يغفر له في شهر رمضان لم يغفر له إلى مثله من قابل إلا أن يشهد عرفة.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam stated, if a person remains unforgiven in the month of Ramadan, he will not be forgiven in any other month after it, unless he is able to attend the plains of Arafah during the obligatory pilgrimage.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the holy month of Ramadan, this blessed opportunity to change our lives for the better, for forever. Now, one of the issues that comes up is this idea that we must refrain from sin in this holy month of Ramadan. Now, of course, if for 30 days we refrain from sinning to the best of our ability, then inshallah, by the grace and the blessings of Allah, the rest of the year we will also be able to refrain from these sins. Now, sometimes we feel like asking for forgiveness and repentance and istighfar. Yes, it is one way of, let's say, erasing the sins that we have committed, or making up or compensating for the sins that we have committed. But sometimes we think, well, I want to do more. You know, I really feel bad. I really feel ashamed for what I did, for the disobedience that I committed in the presence of the Almighty Allah. I really feel like I need to do more in order to compensate and turn back these effects and this stain of a certain sin. Well, very quickly, I'm just going to tell you a few things that we can do in order to help us to truly repent and feel comfortable and really feel at ease that we have tried our best. Of course, one should never be overconfident and think, oh, God is going to forgive me for sure, no matter what, and I'm going to keep on sinning. No, this is not what is meant. What is meant is that, you know, we will try our best, and then we will put our hope and faith that Allah will forgive us, inshallah, which, you know, He will. One of the things that we can do is to have faith, strengthen our faith, to do good deeds, righteous deeds, and Allah will forgive us. Another one, of course, is to seek forgiveness for your own self and to seek forgiveness for others. Of course, you know, performing the prayers, the salah, as the Holy Quran says in chapter 11, verse number 114, and perform the prayer, surely the good deeds will drive away the evil deeds. Of course, avoiding major sins, joining a kind of struggle, a struggle for the path of Allah, the struggle for the cause of Allah, and even if you attain martyrdom in it, as the Holy Quran says in chapter 3, verse number 195, and they fought and were slain. And then it continues and says that them, I, Allah, shall surely acquit of their evil deeds. Two other things very quickly. One is paying the alms and helping those in need and solving the problems of others. And interestingly, one last thing, in order to atone, one of the things that can be done as far as the traditions is concerned is to say salam, greetings to other people, to give food to the needy, and to conduct the night prayers while others are asleep. Beautiful things in the holy month of Ramadan that we can do to turn a new leaf over and start a new life. This is Dialogue, the holy month of Ramadan.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Haidar Jaffer.
So Maher Ramadan, do not look at it as a negative aspect. It is a positive revolution whereby in this revolution, I am the soldier, I am the commander-in-chief, I am the general, I am the ruler, and I will reap the rewards, nobody else. If we look at it in this way, then we will find that our life will change and our thought process will change. And of course, What is the point of all this? To get closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to gain taqwa, which means being aware of Allah at all times and getting close to Him as much as possible, so that when it is time for me to go, when Malakul Maut comes, perhaps this ayat will apply to me. Ya ayyatuha nafsul mutma'inna, irji'i ila rabbiki radiyatam mardiyya. Right? O tranquil soul, return to your Lord pleased with Him, and He pleased with you. This is the ultimate success that we are looking for. This is what Maah Ramadan is all about.
Ya awwal كل شيء وآخر يا إله.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Ya ilaha kull shay'in wa malika, ya rabba kull shay'in wa sani.
West loves Israel. I am Edward Said. I was born in 1935 into a Christian family in Palestine. I was forced to leave my homeland after the occupation of Palestine. I lived in Egypt and Lebanon for a while and eventually went to the U.S. I studied English literature and became a distinguished professor at one of the most prestigious U.S. universities. But the Six-Day War in 1967 reminded me again that I was the child of an occupied homeland and a fugitive. I asked myself why no one in the U.S. and the West paid attention to this brutal occupation. When I studied Western literature and history with this question in my mind, I realized that the West not only has no problems with Israel, but also loves Israel. My years of research in literary and historical texts led me to a theory that I proposed in Orientalism.
I was struck by the consistency and the coherence of pictures or representations of the East, or the Orient as I called it, in a lot of European culture, you know, say 19th century French paintings by Gérôme, for instance, or novelistic writing, say, in the work of people like Flaubert and Disraeli, say, and sort of scholarly writing by linguists and historians and anthropologists and sociologists. The consistency of the picture that emerged of something called the Orient, and this collective portrait of the Orient grew in the 19th century and became as consistent as it was. And I related it to and I think this was one of the things that was quite controversial. I related it to European power. I was saying, really, that there is no such thing as the Orient. The Orient is much more complicated, much more varied, much more heterogeneous, and above all, much more detailed than any of these grand generalizations about, well, we know that Orientals tend to think in certain ways. That, for example, one of the things I mentioned in the early part of the book was Lord Cromer, who's saying the Oriental mind is different from ours. It is not capable of grasping Western logic. You know, an Egyptian, for example, cannot walk on the sidewalk, you would say. You know, he has to walk on the street. That's a function of the mind. And I was saying, all of that's absolute nonsense. You know, you can't make these generalizations and then pretend that they are factual or scientific generalizations. They are rooted in rule.